So
Okay.
I mean, so far we haven't dealt with super
to call the House Committee on Health Care to order for this penultimate day of February. And I'm going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 2122. Madam Minister, what have we got here? I lost it. I'll tell you what we have here. The question was, you want to tell us about this bill?
Are we going on House Bill 2122?
2122. We open a public hearing on House Bill 2122.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2122 comes to you at the request of Representative Greenlick. The bill modifies the requirements for the coordinated care organizations for in 2018 and 2023 requires the CCOs to be community-based nonprofit organizations, to have a membership of a governing body that reflects local control, and to distribute at least 80% of the payments to providers using alternative payment methodologies. Creates the Community Escrow Fund and the State Treasury to hold the CCO restricted reserves, requires the Oregon Health Policy Board to adopt minimum criteria for the continuation of contracts for the CCOs. Mr. Chair, if the committee chooses to take action on the bill, this does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. There are no amendments at this time, Mr. Chair. Mr. Vice Chair.
Welcome, Mr. Chair and Madam Speaker. Which one of you wants to kick off?
Madam Speaker.
Okay. You can defer to me.
Yes.
Please state your name for the record, Madam Speaker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Tina Kotek, State Representative, House District 44, North and Northeast Portland, and Speaker of the House. Thank you for the opportunity to speak about House Bill 2122 today. One of the reasons I'm here is, as the longer we serve in this building, the individuals who were involved 6 years ago in the creation of our current structure in the Oregon Health Plan, of people have left this building, or in the case of Dr. Bates, left us. And many of us sat in windowless rooms for many months trying to come up with the transformation plan. And so I'm here today to speak on this bill because it is the next step in moving us forward in transformation here in Oregon. Back in 2011, when we worked on this, our goals were to get better value for the money we invested in care, truly move away from a fee-for-service model toward value-based payments, provide the flexibility to innovate and address community needs, and do all this while keeping at a cost curve of 3.4%. CCOs, our coordinated care organizations, have done a wonderful job of serving Oregon's Medicaid expansion population. Since 2013, approximately 400,000 new people have enrolled. We could not have done that without the transformation that came with CCOs. We have had initial success through 60% increase in patient-centered primary care and home enrollment since 2011, and a corresponding decrease in hospital admissions for chronic diseases by 60%. But we have more work to do, and that's what this bill is about. When we began this journey, we knew we needed to keep innovating and moving stronger towards integration. This bill, House Bill 2122, keeps challenging us to do that, to move us in the right direction, not only for the next 5 years, but the next 10 or 20 years and past that. I want to speak to a couple issues here. You see in the bill some language around governance. It's really important, and it was the intent of the early transformation work to make sure that CCOs reflect the communities they serve. And while many CCOs have already embraced the role that their community advisory councils have, I support making sure that we ensure that all CCOs have a strong connection to their community. The issue of reserves is addressed in this bill. CCOs are made possible by Oregonians' tax dollars, serving a publicly supported population of individuals. Right now, CCOs deliver care to 25% of Oregonians. through taxpayer-funded services. So it is our responsibility to protect those funds and the people they serve. As it stands, and we've learned over the last couple of years, our taxpayer money is intended to pay for health care and not enrich executives and shareholders. So the reserve piece of this bill is really important to protect our public investment. This bill also talks about transparency, holding the CCOs accountable, and more transparency in how they do that, and I support that. And lastly, really pushes us, challenges us to continue our innovation in the CCOs, particularly around alternative payment methodologies in Section 9. When we wrote the bill, in I don't know if this was 2011 or 2012, but we encouraged our CCOs to embrace alternative payment methodologies under a global budget to provide cost savings and quality. This bill would now require alternative payment methodologies as listed in statute for 80% of payments. We need to do that. We will not have sustainable transformation without it. So with that, I just encourage you to take a very hard look at this bill and help us secure the future of our healthcare transformation here in Oregon. Thank you very much.
Chair Greenlee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be brief so we can move on. Thank you, Madam Speaker, for joining us this morning.
No, I did not.
I think we've done an amazing
Representative
job.
Representative Greenlee, you have to introduce yourself for the record.
That vice chair of yours.
Yeah.
It tell you.
I'm State Representative Mitch Greenlee, House District 33, and thank you for allowing me to speak today, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome.
I think as the Speaker pointed out, we've done an amazing job over the past 5 years. But now we need to look forward to what creates a sustainable future. This bill looks both at the next five and the five after that. It talks about how we move into the future in a way that makes this this transformation real and continuing. It does have a set of elements that I think are very important, and I just want to comment on two of those and also point out there there are some amendments coming toward this bill, both that I've asked for and that others have asked for, and we'll have plenty of time to discuss it as we move forward. Why does the question of the nonprofit or profit status matter? People say, well, there are a lot of nonprofit organizations and their managers behave in some ways, sometimes very much like they're a part of a major profit corporation. And that, in a sense, is true. But the legal requirement of a manager in a for-profit organization is their first obligation is for their shareholders. They have a legal obligation to make decisions in the best interest of their shareholders. Sometimes the best interest of the shareholders is consistent with the best interest of the public, but certainly not always. And as we have new for-profit organizations moving into the field, moving into CCOs, as our colleagues from Eugene have been telling us all along, with the entry of Centene into the field, life has changed. The legal obligation of the managers of a nonprofit organization, particularly a 501c3, an eleemosynary institution, is to make decisions in the best interest of the community they serve. That's a very different requirement of a manager than making decisions in the best interest of the shareholders, their legal responsibility. Cultures follow from those two different approaches to their legal responsibility that ends up not giving us confidence that a for-profit organization is always thinking of the best interests of the community it serves. One of the amendments I'm putting forward will bring some more transparency into this field. We asked the Oregon Health Policy Board to look at this question and to make some recommendations for us. And one recommendation after another that they made says we have to increase the transparency of the governance of this system. We will have an amendment to help that even further. The other question is the reserves. Right now, the reserves are owned by the CCO. There are $925 million in reserves in the 16 CCOs in our state. Almost $1 billion in reserves. Those reserves currently are controlled by the CCOs themselves. Centene, for example, which now owns the CCO in Lane County, has already abandoned two Medicaid systems around the country. I think the two are Kentucky and Texas. I'm not sure about Kentucky, but I think those are the two. And they decide in the best interest of their shareholders is to fold up their operation and take off. The reserves go with them. This bill puts the reserves in a place that we can preserve them for, hold them in the best interest of the community. Those, I think, are two of the key features. Those that have caused the most discussion so far, but we'll have room to talk about both the question of how you properly evaluate the performance of a CCO, which is one of the issues, and the other, how you deal with advanced payment methodology. And I think I'll stop there unless if you have some questions of either of us.
Representative Cameron has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Chair, how many of the CCOs are now currently nonprofit?
I think the number is 6 of the 16 are one form or another of nonprofit organizations.
6.
Something like that. It's 5 or 6. Of the majority are organized for profit. Most of the ones that are organized for profit are limited liability corporations that are owned mostly by the physicians and the hospitals in the community as joint ventures. But there are a variety of different profit forms.
Excuse me if I
follow up, sure.
You know, just going back in history, you know, part of it is we were trying to see what would happen with different models. So it'll be interesting to see the testimony that follows.
Well, it goes back in history in a very important way. As we designed the CCO movement in its heart was in the 2011 session. We had a 30-30 split in the House, and we had the promise of $1.9 billion hanging over us, which had the speakers and the president of the Senate very much anxious to get this bill done. As we were debating the kind of issues, there was a very clear discussion about do we mean community-based nonprofit organizations, or do we mean profit-making, essentially Medicaid MCOs on steroids? We never could resolve that because we were under this pressure to get the damn thing done. We'll figure it out later. We got the damn thing done, and we got the $1.9 billion, which saved our budget in that period, and now's the time to straighten it out later.
Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Vice Chair Nose. As we look at the legislation, if this is what we choose to go forward with and look at the current makeup of the CCOs, we've got 6 or so nonprofit. Is it the intent of this legislation to make those 6 larger and work within that framework, or allow the 16 there to restructure to, I mean, because it's kind of a structuring process, would it allow time for them to restructure to this if we pass it, or is this an intent to drive the current model to 6 providers rather than 16?
It is not that. The first 5-year contract runs out, I think, the end of 2018 or early in 2019. So in 2018, we are going to be renegotiating those 5-year contracts. This bill suggests that by the end of the next 5-year period, by 2023, all of the CCOs be nonprofit status. And it requires that as the next contract is negotiated, the for-profit organized CCOs point out how over the following 5 years they'll be able to move toward becoming a nonprofit organization. So it gives lots of time for them to work their way through the process to move. It is not intended to expand the existing nonprofits to take over the field.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Do you want to call Jeff in?
Sure.
Greg Johnston and Josh Bauer. Oh, no. Charlie Swanson, Pam Lovett.
Stand by.
Call Charlie Swanson, Courtney Johnson, and Josh Ballack.
Okay. I'd like to call Charlie Swanson, Courtney Johnson, and Josh Ballack. And when each of you take your time to testify, if you would please remember to introduce yourselves for the record.
Hello. Thank you, Chair Mitch Greenlick, Vice Chairs Cedric Hayden and Rob Noes. I'm Charlie Swanson, and I'm representing Healthcare for All Oregon and Healthcare for All Oregon Action in supporting House Bill 2122 and in suggesting some modifications for consideration. I've submitted more detailed written testimony, but would like to emphasize several things. To us, the most important effect of this bill would be to strengthen the function of CCOs as community organizations. The 2011 bill that established CCOs stated that coordinated care organizations may be local community-based organizations or statewide organizations with community-based participation in governance or any combination of the two. We completely agree. CCOs need to have a strong community connection, though a statewide organization with sufficient community governance can work well. In 2015, CCOs served over 950,000 Oregonians with an overall budget of at least $4.5 billion. For comparison, K-12 education served somewhat fewer than 600,000 students with a budget of $5.4 billion. So CCOs in Oregon serve more people and have nearly as large a total budget as K-12 education. Oregonians have a strong interest in community control of such an important function with such substantial expenditures of public funds, with such substantial potential benefits for society, both society and individuals, just as they do for K-12 education. To ensure that CCOs function as a community partner, a number of the provisions in House Bill 2122 need to be in effect before the next contracting period, especially those in Section 1. Following open meeting laws and limiting the governing board to no more than 25% with a financial stake in the CCO seem most critical. Adding the Oregon Health Policy Board's recommendations regarding transparency and accountability also seem very important. We also strongly favor the requiring CCOs to become nonprofits. Recognizing that this will take some time, as Chair Greenlick pointed out, implementing the community escrow fund provision is necessary to protect the public's money. We also have suggested some additions to the bill regarding transfer of ownership and public health that we hope you will seriously consider. We also have some reservations about the firm requirement for 80% of alternative-based funding. We think that it's useful to go in that direction. It may be more useful to, rather than requiring a firm number, to offer incentives. We just want you to think a little bit carefully about that. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I'll take any questions if the committee has any.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Courtney Johnston, and I'm here today on behalf of the Coalition for a Healthy Oregon, which is an association of coordinated care organizations and affiliated companies representing 8 of the 16 CCOs that serve nearly half of our state's Medicaid population through the Oregon Health Plan. I want to thank you today for the opportunity to testify on what I believe is an integral part of our integral issue, the future of the coordinated care model in Oregon. Since the inception, the CCOs have been tremendously successful at achieving their core mission of improving health outcomes while reducing the cost of care in our state. So I guess I'm here today to ask
I'm having trouble with the connection.
What the what the problem is that we are intending to solve. COHO believes that we have been successful because the legislature created the CCOs in a way that made us accountable to our local communities, and that you built in the flexibility for us to work and be responsive to our local community needs. And that's why we were really pleased to see Chair Greenlick direct the Oregon Health Policy Board last year to engage our local community members and convene 6 listening sessions across the state in order to analyze the current model and look for opportunities to further advance health system transformation with the stated goal of informing the 2017 legislature of their findings. I was able to attend 2 of the 6 meetings, and I can tell you they were very well attended, and they did something that I think is really important in public policy. They provided the policy board with an opportunity to receive input from the people that matter most, the stakeholders affected by the policy, the consumers, the advocates, the healthcare providers, and the other stakeholders who address the same issues that this bill is really looking at addressing, making meaningful improvements to governance, transparency, and accountability, improving the way we address health equity and social determinants of health, accelerating system integration, and finding sustainable solutions to cost drivers. These are all things that COHO is very supportive of moving forward on. Their recommendations were finalized in January of this year, and with a few logistical caveats, they were largely received very favorably by the CCOs. I would just like to ask that we look back and review the progress of this model that has only been operational for a relatively short period of time. We not look to make sweeping changes and to reinvent the wheel, especially if the effect of those changes aren't improving the health outcomes of our communities, but rather we look closely at the recommendations that came out of this inclusive public policy process, and we look to support a system that has worked in our state to provide care for thousands of Oregon's most vulnerable citizens. Thank you.
I can't freaking understand.
Chair Green, like members of the committee, for the record, Josh Ballack, Vice President of Government Affairs and Health Policy for All Care Health. We're a coordinated care organization based in Jackson, Josephine, Curry, and Southern Douglas counties. Looking at 2122, we were actually very pleased when Representative Greenlick and this committee asked the Oregon Health Policy Board to go and out and ask the community, what is it you want to see Transformation 2.0 to look like? What are these types of things? And think that the Oregon Health Policy Board did a very good job of pulling those meetings together. I actually went to the one down in Medford. It was incredibly well attended. I think there were 95 people on a snowy night where I think snowpocalypse started the next day. And it was community members, providers, a few folks from the CCO, but certainly not the majority, and a lot of our members. And they brought up a lot of stuff around mental health integration, around dental care organization. There was one of our partners from Curry County who drove all the way over because she was working at one of the abuse women's crisis shelters over there. And we were able to actually kind of get connected in these types of things. But it really was a community effort. And I think what you ended up getting out of those recommendations out of the Oregon Health Policy Board very much mirror at least what I heard at the one that I heard down in Medford. So, I think going and looking and using a bill based off of those recommendations and using that as the starting point, I think is a much more effective way to be able to keep the local and unique organizations that we have in our 16 CCOs. I mean, if there's a secret sauce that is in the CCOs, it really is that we are locally based, and we've all kind of built these things. And these were birthed in 2011 and 2012, but they have morphed and changed and grown, and they've been built on the structures that were there, and then we've brought new people in, and we've changed some of the ways that we do things. And I think that that's actually really important. The other piece here is also the time that we live in. This is arguably one of the most upsetting or unpredictable healthcare times that we'll ever experience. You've got the federal government doing only God knows what. We have a $900 million hole in our budget that we're going to need to be able to find. And adding more disruption and changing structures, even if it's 10 years off, in the middle of this time will really upset not only but it could hinder our federal efforts, and it also hurts our local providers and our local our local community members, you know, working with public health and these types of things, where they say, well, if the structure's changing, we don't even know if there's going to be any money, and we don't know how many people are going to be in there, what are we going to do? So there's a lot of different pieces that I think that need to be taken into account. I think the beauty of what the Oregon Health Policy Board actually put out as their recommendations was they were able to listen to those each individual unique concerns and crafted recommendations that actually fit so that those each one of our little 16 CCOs could find a glide path to be able to get to where we wanted to go, which was expanding access, or maintaining access, improving quality, pushing us more toward doing community investments and investing in the social determinants of health, something that I think AllCare is doing a very good job at. But we're not the only ones. All of these other CCOs, and I don't care if you're for-profit or non-profit, they all are going down that road. And the new waiver that was put into place actually does have mechanisms in there that actually mandate that we continue to invest in these ways and sets floors for us to be able to do those investments. So I think there are a lot of different moving pieces that do get addressed inside of the Oregon Health Policy Board recommendations and inside of the waiver, and I worry that this might be a little bit too much too fast. I do want to touch on one thing, though. You mentioned the you mentioned the for-profit, non-profit. AllCare actually has become a benefit corporation. It was actually, I believe, Representative Green, like you sponsored the legislation to help create that for the state of Oregon. And by becoming a benefit corporation, that actually protects our now Board of Governors to be able to do long-term investments so that they don't have the fiduciary responsibility to maximize every dollar. And the reason that we did that was it fit what we were already doing, and it gave them the protection to be able to continue making those investments, but also, and equally just as important, it gave direction to future board members. This is who we are, this is what we think, and this is where we're going to go. And I just got a text from my CFO that we just submitted to B-Lab, which is an independent corporation that actually says, if you can say you're B-Lab, but if you're not actually doing good stuff, then they'll kind of call you out on it. So we're actually getting third-party validation, and we were told by our folks that we should be able to pass the pass with enough points in the first go-around. So just wanted to let you guys know on that.
Thank you, Chair Greenlee. Thank you for your presentation. Considering that the K through 12 funding, 35% of that comes from local sources, local taxes, if all of the CCOs and their entities and their buildings and their property holdings were nonprofit, what effect would that make on Oregon's educational system?
Chair Greenlee, Representative Hayden, I know that there are an awful lot of taxpaying entities that are inside of those different places, including us. We pay taxes on our and we are many of our independent physicians do as well. So I think they probably actually have a real hurt because you would end up shrinking the tax base.
You don't follow up?
Sure, but I'd like to check on that one.
Okay,
the physicians. Clinics and things like that would be more than nonprofit status of being. It would be the overall organization. Probably not a lot of real estate that the CCO is himself.
Well, that's my question. I'm asking because I don't know what that tax base is and what the effect is, but I think it would be worth looking at.
Yes.
Chair Greenlee, Representative Hayden, I don't know the answer to that offhand, but we do have headquarters in the local communities, and those are taxpaying entities for the for-profits, so I'm happy to look into what that would be.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Canavan. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe you're not prepared to speak, but you talked about waiver mandates, and I was wondering if you could be a little bit more specific about that. And I think it's a pretty big topic, but I wasn't familiar enough to know for sure.
Chair Greenlee, Representative Kennemer, I know just enough to be dangerous on this, so please take this with a grain of salt. But what happened was they moved the medical loss ratio, or basically the minimum that you had to have spent on actual widgets, so you know something you can encounter, from 80% up to 85%. So that goes into effect in 2017. So that goes into effect, and then once the waiver kicks in, I think in 18, at the end of next year, there will be a piece where you basically have to spend 2% on social determinants of health or community investments, and that can in some cases be counted against your MLR and in other cases not. But it's pushing us to continue to invest in the community. And I think that was a big piece. And the nice part is that we can actually get credit now with the federal government for doing those community investments or not. I think it's referred to as non-traditional medical services or something along those lines. And that includes both community investments and these flexible services, for that lack of a better term, the air conditioner. So
we can get somebody in who knows something about it and talk about it. It would be interesting for us to know that. Representative Hack.
Thank you, Chair.
No, not yet, sir. We have Pam Levitt, Jeremiah Rigsby, and Jesse O'Brien.
I just have a quick comment. I just think that it's important that we, and you, Josh, you brought up a good point on the national level. I think we have an opportunity to possibly be a leader in what a CCO looks like. So I would just caution us to proceed with due diligence, in that we certainly have an opportunity again to possibly be the lead, and we have an opportunity to be the ones that are on the forefront of what a CCO could look like for others. So while there's some good things in this, I just would hate to see the unintended mistake of getting in the way of some of that good work that could happen for us as well. So,
and Chair Greenlee or Rep Hack, I was really interesting within 24 hours Senator Wyden and Representative Walden, or Congressman Walden, both say good things about the CCO model, and they really are looked upon nationally as a model of delivering increased quality care at lower costs. It's a pretty remarkable thing we've done.
Exactly what this bill is intended to continue. Thank you. Next panel, please.
Pam Levitt, Jeremiah Rigsby, Jesse O'Brien. And then Jonathan Ames after that.
Jesse, okay, can I go?
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlee, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jesse O'Brien. I'm the policy director for OSPIRG, which is the Oregon State Public Interest Research Group, a statewide consumer and taxpayer advocate organization. I mentioned the taxpayer part because we are interested in this legislation not just as an advocate for all Oregon consumers, including consumers within the CCO system, but also as an advocate for Oregon taxpayers who are, you know, paying the tab for all of this, which I think is very relevant. We're here in support of this legislation. I think, you know, some of the details could still use a little bit more work, but we're generally very supportive of this approach. We helped host a forum on the future of the coordinated care model in October, which, although it was not actually part of the Oregon Health Policy Board process, we supplied detailed notes from our forum to the Oregon Health Policy Board following up on the panel. And I feel like the components of this bill really echo what we heard at that forum from a wide range of stakeholders in terms of where people wanted to see this go in a lot of different ways. So there's obviously some disagreement, but, you know, we heard from people from the CCOs. We heard from Representative Greenlee. He was there. We heard from a number of medical providers, health advocates, and I think most importantly, representatives from the community advisory councils, from CCOs in a number of different parts of the state. And the things that I think they could all agree on is that we need more transparency and accountability. We need more accountability to communities and accountability in governance. And I feel like this bill would take some really big, important steps toward making that real. We need to know more about where our money is going in this system, and we need more financial transparency and accountability, and we need to continue to raise the bar to make sure that CCOs are actually doing the hard work and making the investments they need to make to transform the system, improve quality of care, contain costs, and I think this bill is definitely a big step in the right direction, and this is exactly the conversation we should be having right now. Thank you.
Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, my name is Pam Levitt, and I'm here today representing Pacific Source Community Solutions. We're part of the Pacific Source family of companies, and I will be very brief. I know you have a busy day ahead of you. Pacific Source is an independent, not-for-profit, health-based plan in Oregon serving Medicaid, Medicare, and commercial members. Pacific Source Community Solutions serves approximately 48,000 members in the three-county area of Central Oregon and the two-county area in the Columbia Gorge, Hood, and Wasco counties. Thank you for convening this important discussion today about how best to build upon our innovative CCO model. I have to say we are very proud supporters of our CCO model. We are strong supporters of the CCO community-driven model and believe our two CCOs have created a framework that allows for strong provider relationships and meaningful community priority setting and reinvestment. We understand there are many forthcoming and that are informed by the Oregon Health Policy Board's important community listening sessions. We're here today to say we'd like to be partners in those discussions and look forward to seeing the amendments. Thank you, Chair.
All of the folks on all sides of this discussion, if you have amendments to propose, let's start proposing them so we can have a suite of amendments we can look at. This might help our discussion.
Thank you, Chair Greenlake and members of the committee. My name is Jeremiah Rigsby. I work for CARE Oregon. We're a nonprofit that owns two CCOs, Columbia Pacific CCO in the northwest portion of the state, Jackson Care Connect down in Jackson County. We also work closely with Health Share, and together we touch about 200,000 people in the Oregon Health Plan. We have always been for pushing CCOs to go further and doing more to maintain our place on the mantle as a leader nationally in managed Medicaid. We have worked closely with our friends at our CCOs over the last few years on legislation that has popped up, and one of the places CARE Oregon has often landed is continuing to hold CCOs responsible for getting better and having an impact on healthcare delivery system transformation, and we think this bill is the first step towards that. It's not that we love everything in the bill, and it's not that we hate much in the bill. It's just we're doing a lot of things right now that we've established over the last 5 years that we want to continue to do while pushing the bar up. And we want to be part of any one of those conversations. I think there was a really great healthcare discussion that happened in the short session in 2016. We unfortunately lost a very strong advocate for the CCO system and healthcare transformation and losing Senator Bates. And it's really great to see this discussion continue. I know that you had introduced Chair Greenlake HB 4100 at the beginning of 2016. And now that's...
Oh, gosh, dang it.
I know. It was frustrating for a lot of people. at the same time, this is the first time I think, and to me, this. Yeah.
No,
yeah.
I just. Ma'am, who's on the phone? My understanding is that this is going through a closed caption. Is your server not working? Hello? Okay.
It's good kind of timing, though, Jeremy.
looking forward, we put a lot of effort into the Oregon Health Policy Board recommendations, and we all kind of assumed that they were going to be part of this discussion. And this discussion really hasn't happened on the record yet, so I'm assuming that we're going to have multiple amendments and multiple hearings, and we're going to want to bring a lot of the people from our organizations that are doing a lot of this work in the trenches to talk about what's working in the metro area versus the rural areas versus the different types of rural areas. And it might not be entertaining enough for K2 News, but I think it's going to be really, really important. And we're looking forward to that conversation. So, that's all right.
We have one more witness. Jonathan Ames, will you join us? We will be having more discussion. Let me share.
I thought this was the only one. I had a whole big speech prepared.
No, let's play.
For the record, my name is Jonathan Eames. I'm here on behalf of Healthcare Oregon, largest CCO here in the state, 501c3 not-for-profit, representing we have about 200,000 folks that are members of the the Coordinated Care Organization, HealthShare. I think a lot of the comments that have been made already up to this point have been good comments. What's really encouraging about this is that, like HealthShare, the CCOs are open to this conversation, want to work with the legislature, not against the legislature, to see if we can find the best possible policy going forward. You do have an opportunity. My gosh, we've been, it seems like just yesterday that we passed this bill, 3650, in 2011, where there were 82 amendments or something like that. I'm hoping that will not be the case this time. But, you know, HealthShare definitely supports the aims and the goals of this legislation. As Mr. Rigsby said, we do have to push ourselves and we have to push forward to see if we can change the statute and change our policies to better suit the needs not only of the legislature but of the members that we serve. The Oregon Health Policy Board process that really focused on what the needs were from the community. I think they did a great job doing the statewide tour. We hope that those are reflected in whatever legislation is the final pieces of legislation. And we are looking forward to having that conversation with you, Mr. Chair, and the members of the committee to see what we can come up with. So thank you for the opportunity and thanks for bringing it forward.
A brief question. Are the health share and governance meetings held in public?
Are the main board, that the community advisory councils are public, but the government, they are not.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Close the public hearing on House Bill 41. And open the public hearing on House Bill 2673.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2673 comes to you at the request of Representative Nose. It provides for an alternative process for persons to change the name and gender on a vital record. It eliminates the requirement for courts to publicly post the court orders on the name and gender changes, takes effect on the 91st day following adjournment sine die.
Mr. Chair,
and we do.
You want to introduce it?
I'm not going to say very much, but it's not very often I have the honor of my majority leader and good friend kicking off on one of my bills, so I'm going to let her talk about it.
There you go. Please introduce yourself. I forgot to do that.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick, members of the committee. My name is Jennifer Williamson. I am the state representative for House District 36. I am the majority leader, and I am a co-chief sponsor on this bill with you, Mr. Chair, and Vice Chair Nose. Colleagues, for transgender individuals, discrimination is a regular occurrence, and it's alive and well in this country. In recent years, we've seen states codifying discrimination, and even last week, the federal government rolled back protections for transgender students. Here in Oregon, we've been a leader in ensuring that every Oregonian has their basic rights protected, but of course, there's more we can do. This bill gives transgender Oregonians a more streamlined, affordable, and private option as they seek to ensure that their legal identity matches their who they truly are. It creates an administrative process through the Oregon Health Authority for transgender individuals to change their name and gender without the involvement of the courts. To put this in perspective, just 1 in 10 transgender Oregonians have an ID that match their gender identity. This bill also updates outdated public posting requirements that risk outing people and share private and personal medical information. With easier access to legal identification, individuals will be less likely to face discrimination in areas that we take for granted every day, like applying for a job, renting a house, or accessing medical care. So, colleagues, I urge you to pass this bill and take Oregonians and Oregon closer to full equity and equality in this state. And I thank you for your time.
Is there any questions in this week?
Hayden.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick. Looking at this bill, I'd like some time to work with some amendments on it. I think there may be other populations that would benefit from being able to make a change to the vital record. Example of that could be, I've got to talk to Elsie, but an example of that could be foster parents that adopt children. And when they travel overseas, it can become very burdensome. And you can leave the states with those documentations pretty easily because the foreign governments don't really look at them. For appropriate reasons, when you bring a child or a minor back into the states that doesn't have your last name, which is based on your vital record to get that passport, it can be very difficult to prove that that child should be with you, and inhibits travel sometimes for folks that want to take their families, which they have adopted, but they can't prove it. So I have asked for time to look into that and see if this is a bill that other populations might also benefit from. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Could you call the next panel, please?
Brooke Shelley, Jay Gibbons, Neola Young.
Whoever.
Yeah.
Introduce yourself.
Chair Greenlake and members of the committee, my name is Brooke Shelley, for the record, and I serve as co-chair of the Basic Rights Oregon Board of Directors. I'm pleased to bring forward House Bill 2673 on behalf of transgender Oregonians across the state. Basic Rights Oregon works to ensure that all lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer Oregonians experience equality. This legislation is a necessary step in the right direction to ensure the rights of all Oregonians. As the organizational sponsor of the bill, we strongly urge you to support a House Bill 2673 with the -3 amendment, because it will greatly reduce discrimination for transgender people by allowing us to safely, efficiently, and affordably obtain personal documentation that accurately reflects our gender identity. While Oregon is on the forefront of the LGBT equality nationally, thanks to the work of this legislature, transgender Oregonians remain among the most vulnerable and misunderstood community members. For those unfamiliar, transgender is the term used to describe a person whose gender is not the same as the sex they were assigned at birth. Unfortunately, because of the lack of awareness and acceptance in society, more than 40% of us attempt suicide in our lifetimes, and we are also 4 times more likely to live in poverty than other residents of our state. House Bill 2673 will mitigate this crisis, as identity documents are a crucial part of personal, social, and workforce acceptance. Unfortunately, the current court process is intrusive, expensive, and hard to navigate. Currently, updating your birth certificate requires a transgender person to go through a court to request a legal name change or gender marker amendment. Next, we take the court order to OHA's Center for Health Statistics Department, which administers vital records. Because of the current court process, many in our community are at risk of being asked sensitive, private medical information in open court, being outed to the public, or consequently being discriminated against or harmed. And this risk is an undue burden on transgender Oregonians. Additionally, the court process is inconsistent from county to county and quite expensive, as it adds another layer of court and attorney fees. As many of us are impoverished, the price is often too high for us to access. House Bill 2673 would make 2 simple fixes to existing Oregon law to ensure that transgender Oregonians have access to a safer, more affordable, and efficient process. First, it would centralize the administrative process to change a name or a gender marker on a birth certificate by creating a single, streamlined process at the Oregon Health Authority for transgender Oregonians. This proposed change would not eliminate the court order option, but would provide a safe, effective method for transgender people to remove our barriers to access. Our records would still be subject to the existing verification processes in OHA's Center for Health Statistics Department. This process would closely resemble the federal process for updating the Social Security documentation. Secondly, the bill would modernize outdated public posting requirements in the court process. Currently, even if a court takes electronic petitions, a person may have to physically go to the court and post their petition on a public board twice. This onerous and outdated practice puts all Oregonians at risk of identity theft and adds logistical difficulty. However, it especially puts transgender individuals at risk of being publicly outed and discriminated against. The -3 amendment will allow the health authority and the Oregon Judicial Department sufficient time to prepare to implement the bill. It will also allow transgender Oregonians access to court processes for gender marker amendment in any circuit court in the state and ensure that they can seal the record of their gender amendment petition for privacy and safety concerns. As a senior engineer, I'm one of the fortunate ones. When I decided to leave Texas, a state that does not recognize my gender, my skills were sought after by companies here in Oregon. I chose Oregon because of the robust and strong tech community here, as well as the value that our state puts on equality. But we're not done yet. Passing House Bill 2673 with the Dash 3 amendment is an important step in our effort to ensure that all Oregonians are treated with dignity and respect and can live free from discrimination. We strongly urge this committee to pass this bill. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, my name is Jay Gibbons, and I'm here today to share my story in support of HB 2673, a bill to help transgender Oregonians. I publicly came out as transgender several years ago and started using a different name. I was finally living as the person I had always known myself to be. This name represents my identity, one that I have spent considerable time and effort struggling to come to terms with, and also present truthfully to my family and friends. Currently, none of my identity documents have my correct name, nor do they reflect who I am. As a working class person, the cost of updating these documents was out of reach for years. And even if I had saved up the money earlier, I didn't know who to talk to or where to go. The process is confusing and cumbersome. Another thing that stopped me was the public posting rule. As a transgender person, I fear for my safety because of my identity. So as you can imagine, having my old feminine-sounding name posted publicly for everyone to see and then called out in a courtroom of people I don't know is scary and prohibitive. I am challenged in countless ways because my identity documents do not reflect my correct name. After saving the money and building up the courage, I finally began the process to update these documents in January of 2017. This was sparked because I realized in January that I had an infection for which I needed urgent medical care. However, it took me 48 hours to work up the courage to go to the doctor. Because I do not have updated IDs, I knew as soon as I checked in, the staff people at the front desk would misgender me and call me the wrong name. When I was called back, they would yell out the wrong name for the whole waiting room to hear as people stared at me. And when I finally made it back, the nurse would ask me uncomfortable and deeply personal questions that did not relate to me, all because my ID is wrong. These situations are exhausting, especially when I was seeking medical help for a small issue like an infection. You have the power to improve these circumstances for transgender people like me in Oregon. One of the greatest challenges of being a transgender person is having people affirm and support my identity. It is harmful to be misgendered and called the wrong name. It hurts, and it cuts away at all of the work I have done to be exactly who I am. I can't walk down the street without people staring a little too long. And just this summer, at a diner, as my partner and I ate lunch, a man stared at us for 15 minutes, not pausing to eat any of his food, as to intimidate us. We eventually got up and left because we feared his stares of intimidation might turn to violence. I've never set up a primary care physician, nor have I sought out the preventative treatment I need to maintain my asthma. All because it is far worse to be outed and invalidated as a transgender person. A small amount of bullying can lead to poor mental health, and fear of the doctor's office makes people sick for longer. You can change what people see when they look at me and when they look at my ID. The current process is very challenging, and I urge you to take this opportunity to support this bill and put this process in reach for transgender Oregonians like me and help us thrive. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Mitch Greenlick and members of the committee, my name is Nola Young. I'm here to support House Bill 2673, which would remove several barriers transgender Oregonians face when updating crucial identity documents. Over the past 5 years, I've worked as an advocate for transgender Oregonians seeking IDs that reflect their names and correct gender markers. Having updated identity documents means more access to important life activities like getting a job, enrolling in school, opening a bank account, purchasing insurance, all examples of how we improve our quality of life and in turn improve our communities. Some transgender people who use an ID that doesn't match gender or gender presentation face harassment, humiliation, and even violence. They are more likely to be denied jobs, housing, and health care. I have personally assisted more than 100 transgender Oregonians in updating identity documents because I know that it is always life-changing and at times life-saving. For a population that already suffers disproportionately from hiring discrimination, unemployment, and poverty, every extra step and every fee can create barriers to getting accurate identity documents. For any Oregonian to update their name, including transgender Oregonians, they must get a court order, which involves many steps, including public posting and going before a judge in open court. However, there is a significant difference in changing your last name from Smith to Jones and changing your first name from Jennifer to Jack. In the second example, that greatly increases one's risk because it reveals deeply personal information because of the gendered nature of our names. I often work in healthcare where patient privacy is taken incredibly seriously because revealing someone's personal health information can compromise their safety. This bill helps address that issue for transgender Oregonians because it gives transgender person the option to increase their privacy by eliminating questions in open court and public posting requirements that reveal sensitive health-related information. Additionally, by eliminating the requirement for a court order to update one's Oregon birth record, it reduces the associated fees and streamlines the process. Oregon can ensure that transgender and gender nonconforming people born here every year will be far more able to find work, to travel, and to participate confidently in society. I urge you to approve HB 2673, knowing that you will be making transgender and gender nonconforming Oregonians safer and improving our quality of life, which benefits all of Oregon. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you very much. Yeah. Any questions? Thank you very much.
Chair.
Can you call the next balance?
She has a question over here. Can you go ahead?
Oh, yeah.
No, I just want to make a comment, Mr. Chair. I just want to thank you for your very brave testimony. It's if it's already hard to have the posting in the court to come here in front of a public audience, it takes a lot of courage. So thank you for speaking on behalf of so many people.
We hope you feel supported in doing it. Would you call the next panel?
Sure. Erica Wagner, or Wagner, I apologize for mispronouncing, Oblio Storyman, and Ed Reeves. I did. That one, straight on.
Any order, just introduce yourself.
Chair Mitch Greenlick and members of the committee, thank you very much for having us here today. For the record, I am Erica Wegner, Transgender Services Coordinator at Outside In Medical Clinic in Portland, Oregon. I am here to voice support for HB 2673, which would remove several barriers to identity change for thousands of transgender and gender nonconforming Oregonians. As the Transgender Services Coordinator at the Outside In Medical Clinic, it is one of my responsibilities to run the ID Project. The ID Project is a program providing information, support, and financial aid for transgender and gender nonconforming individuals who are trying to legally change their name and gender markers and update them on IDs. The demand for such a program is very high, as having correct and gender-affirming IDs allows our clients to apply for jobs and housing, to travel, to go out on the weekends, and to move through the world without fear that they will face extra discrimination or bureaucratic hurdles from those who see F when they expect M, or vice versa. In the past 6 months alone, we have provided financial aid to more than 110 people and helped many more through the process in other ways. Every day, I see and help a population which suffers heavily from hiring discrimination, unemployment, and poverty, for whom every extra step and fee can represent an insurmountable barrier to identity change. The people I see are at such a high risk for violent attacks and harassment that the thought of having to announce their name change to the world is enough to make someone stay at home rather than go to the courthouse, especially if they're unsure about the policies in their own county or if they will be treated fairly by staff at the courthouse. I encounter these issues every day and work to ameliorate them for our clients. This bill represents a step in the right direction. By eliminating the requirement for a court order to update one's Oregon birth certificate, reducing the associated fees, standardizing processes, etc., Oregon will bring its policies more in line with the most progressive states in the country and ensure that transgender and gender nonconforming people born here will be far more able to find work, to travel, to participate confidently in civil society. By standardizing processes, those transgender people who, like me, chose to make our lives here in Oregon as adults will be better able and more likely to go through the court procedures and to live openly and free of fear. I urge you to approve this bill and make transgender and gender nonconforming Oregonians safer and prouder of their home. Thank you.
Chair Mitch Greenlick and members of the committee, my name is Oblio Stroyman, and I'm the executive director for Transponder. It's a transgender-founded and led organization, nonprofit, created to empower and support trans and gender-diverse people and our allies. We're based in Eugene and provide support to hundreds of transgender Oregonians and their families in central and southern Oregon. I'm here on behalf of Transponder and also myself to share my story in support of HB 2673, a bill to help transgender Oregonians. Transponder was started by necessity, by a group of us who are navigating systems that do not easily affirm us and at times are downright frightening. One of the major obstacles we each have faced personally and is of major community concern is the name and gender change process. The obstacles we face are monetary, bureaucratic, and psychological. As a professional in the mental health field with an alter-abled son, the cost of updating my identity documents was a monetary barrier for years. Even if I made my own documentation changes a monetary priority, I didn't know where to start the process. The process is confusing, it's cumbersome, it requires medical visits and a public posting of private information. There are psychological and emotional barriers, and it poses a very real threat to my safety. Currently, only some of my ID documents have the correct gender, which causes confusion when people ask me what my legal gender is. This outs me in ways that doesn't feel safe. This past year, I finally took the steps to make all of my documents congruent, and I'm anxiously awaiting completion of the process. Until recently, my name and address were posted at a courthouse in a public binder, and it was removed when I went to go get it. So it was available to any past and current client of mine or any member of the public. And that's what I learned on Friday, was that it was removed from the binder and we don't know who did it. As a mental health professional, privacy and confidentiality are paramount. I've already had an experience in which a former client sent me a threatening message via social media after I'd made a mandated child abuse report. I'm terrified about what would happen if this information gets in the hands of the wrong person. By the time we step into a courtroom, transgender Oregonians have already had psychological and medical professionals affirm under perjury of the law that we're fit to move forward in our gender and name change process. This should be enough. Our hearing should be a day of celebration marking all of the obstacles we have overcome, a time to be seen as who we are, rather than a day full of fear, red tape, and potential violence. At Transponder, we work hard to find ways to streamline the name and gender change process for trans and gender diverse people, yet every week we hear stories from community members who have had difficulty. This includes Transponder's administration, who sit in a place of privilege because we're all college educated and employed. How can we expect our community members, many of whom are underemployed and emotionally vulnerable, to be able to do this alone and complete it emotionally unscathed? We serve rural Oregonians who travel miles to attend our meetings or use the internet to reach us to support because they don't feel safe to seek support in their communities. They share with us that it's downright dangerous to have incongruent identification and that it's a barrier for them to obtain the services and employment that they need to thrive. We know that when we do not have proper documentation, we are more likely to avoid medical care, more likely to be harassed by law enforcement, and more likely to be outed in unsafe situations. We have higher instances of depression, anxiety, and self-esteem directly related to gender-affirming obstacles, and this contributes to challenges in seeking and maintaining gainful employment. I have experienced these things personally and professionally, and these realities are very well documented in the 2015 United States Transgender Survey, the largest survey ever taken of transgender folks.
In this political climate, where states like North Carolina have implemented discriminatory bathroom rules and the federal government has reversed protections for transgender people, I urge you to demonstrate Oregon's leadership for transgender equality and human rights. Today, the name change process is inaccessible for people monetarily and psychologically. It is potentially unsafe for people like me. HB 2673 is an opportunity to put this process in reach of transgender Oregonians and help us thrive. You have the power to improve these circumstances, improve the lives of transgender people like me. Thank you, members of the committee, for the opportunity to speak. I urge you to support HB 2673.
Thank you. Hello, Chair Greenlick and members of the committee. My name is Ed Reeves. I'm a partner at Stoll Reeves in Portland, Oregon. I'm also a volunteer lawyer for the American Civil Liberties Union and Basic Rights Oregon. I've been practicing law for over 30 years, but in the last 5 years, I've spent a lot of time dealing with transgender name changes and sex change orders. I have represented a half a dozen clients and have trained 75 lawyers on how to do this work under the current onerous statute. You have my written testimony, so I won't read it other than to make a couple of highlights. This issue came to me because a transgender radiologist who lived in Moscow, Idaho, but was born in Hermiston, Oregon, was trying to get her birth certificate changed and couldn't figure out under the existing statute how she could do that. It took a lot of clever lawyering, but we figured a way around all of the various problems that exist in the current statute. And I want to focus on two particular parts of the current statute. I know that we're creating an administrative process here, but the reform of the court order process also needs to take place because it is onerous and it carves people out of access. Not every state in the United States will give a gender change order. So if you are an unlucky person that happens to live in Idaho or North Dakota or, you know, other states, Arizona, Tennessee, and you happen to be born in Oregon, you can't get the order in your state in order to change your birth certificate here. So, and the problem with our current statute is that it states that you have to do this process in the county in which you reside. Mm-hmm. And so that basically carves those people out. But the other thing is, if you have representation, that lawyer can, in essence, stand in your shoes, and that's how we got around to the first thing. Okay, the other process, part of the process that really needs to be reformed, has to do with this posting requirement. In Multnomah County, a lawyer, in order to file a petition, has to do so electronically. You're not allowed to actually go in with paper into the courtroom, into the court and file. But after you've filed electronically from your office, then you have to go to the courthouse three different times to do all these postings. And it is a challenging process. It's cost ineffective in terms of what time costs if you're hiring a lawyer to do it. But it's also a challenge to people that are trying to work to make ends meet because they have to take off work three different times in order to go and make these postings. And I don't even understand why. I was recently in a courthouse in Florida. They still post divorces. Mm. And I'm standing there thinking, wow, this is onerous and arcane. We don't do that in Oregon, and we shouldn't do this about name changes and gender changes either. I urge you to pass this bill with the -3 amendments. It is going to be a much better process for transgender Oregonians going forward. Does anybody have any questions?
Thank you very much for your testimony. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2073.
I'll go get it. We have two people. Do we want to?
Okay. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2451. And can you tell us what this bill is and call the first count?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2451 comes before the committee at the request of Representative Parrish. It establishes medical assistance eligibility for individuals under the age of 26 who have aged out of the foster care system in Oregon or another state. requires the Oregon Health Authority to seek federal matching funds for costs of medical assistance provided to the individuals who aged out of the foster care in Oregon or another state. And we have... Representative Parrish and then Brian Margotin? Morganton?
Yeah,
I'm going to try to
fly in here.
You're on. You can. And who's the other person?
Brian, he's coming.
Yeah, come on up.
Okay. Interesting. All right, thank you. Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, for the record, Julie Parrish, House District 37, bringing you what I hope is a very simple bill. So this actually came out of our work in the last couple of years on the House Human Services and Housing Committee, where we had heard testimony from foster kids about access to healthcare issues. And in our research, what we found was that while kids from Oregon who age out of the foster care system are able to access our Affordable Care Act plans through Oregon Health Authority, they are, if they did not age out of our system, but they aged out of another state, those children are not eligible for our health care here in Oregon. So there is a little amendment to change line 6 to, from 19 to 18 years old because of when we count folks on an age out. But it's a really small population of kids. And whether they were in Texas or whether they were our kiddos here in Oregon, it's a population of kids that still has no parents, no matter where they're living, or parents that are not capable of, clearly we're not capable of caring for them. And so we don't know what the population is. We think it's small, like probably 100 or less who might access this over the course of time. But it's the right thing to do and just bring that parity up for kiddos who are aged out from other states and make sure that they have the tools that they need to be successful if they are living here in Oregon. So with that, I'm just going to turn it over to Brian.
Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, my name is Brian Morgantini, for the record. I work in Seaside, Oregon. I moved here about 4 months ago. I work for a small nonprofit that specifically my job is program outreach coordinator to the population that you're speaking about. Between 18 and 26 foster youth that weren't adopted who, you know, really don't have a safety net or any other resources. So one of the resources is healthcare. And I educate that population, try to reach out to them and make sure that they have it. I moved from Pennsylvania. Just to tell you a little background. I grew up in the Pennsylvania foster care system from the time I was 4 until I was 21. I aged out at 21 and was covered there. I became an advocate for foster youth nationally, and one of the organizations was Foster Club, and they ended up hiring me and offering me a job in Oregon, so I could choose to stay in Pennsylvania and keep my health insurance, or I can come to this small nonprofit that doesn't provide health insurance, but get a job. And in 2014, there was a statistic that actually comes from my organization. One in two former foster youth that are 24 are employed. That's it. So 50% of them. So I took it upon myself to get a job. But I'm not covered with health insurance. If something happens to me, if I was to happen to get in an accident on the way here, something like that, you know, I have no coverage. And I have... you know, nothing to really do. So I just think it's important to put this in and provide the seamless coverage for youths like me.
Great. Thank you. Is there any questions? We have an amendment coming, I think. Is that right? And
It does. It would be for line 6, and where it just says medical assistance shall be provided to an individual who is over 19 and under 26. It would actually say over 18 and under 26. So this might be the smallest bill that you'll ever see from me in the healthcare committee, 10 lines.
Maybe not the least expensive.
Not the least expensive. But, you know, again, it's a small population, and I think that, you know, we are looking to find ways to cover lots of folks. But, again, these, whether it's Oregon, Texas, Idaho, these are states' children. We are these 50 United States, and I think that this should be seamless. I wish Congress would just do it, but they're not, so we're just taking it upon ourselves to handle it here.
A couple of brief questions, Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick. Thank you.
And our job to get this in Ways and Means, by the way.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you, Representative Parrish, and for the testimony. Very important bill. I enjoyed sitting on Human Services and Housing last session. We don't have that pleasure this time around, but that did come out of this. And just continuity of care for a small population, very important, and hopefully we're successful with that.
Representative Kennedy Geyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was going to say relatively the same thing, and it may be a very small population right now because presumably if you don't have a high-paying job, you might qualify anyway for the Oregon Health Plan. But things could change in the future. We don't know what's going to happen at the federal level, and if OHP coverage gets cut way back, this could be clearly one of the casualties. So I appreciate you bringing this forward, and thank you for coming to testify.
Okay.
That's it. That's our song and dance for the day.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Thank you for coming over. I close the public hearing on House Bill 2451 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2838. Madam Administrator, what have we got?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2838 requires the Oregon Health Authority to improve assistance to individuals who are applying or renewing their medical assistance eligibility for the Oregon Health Plan. We have Connor Gillis, Christian Griffin, Roberto Rios.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick and members of the committee. My name is Connor Gillis. I work as one of two Medicaid outreach and enrollment specialists at Central City Concern in Portland. I'm here today to express my agency's support for HB 2838. CCC works with 13,000 individuals per year on our continuum of affordable support housing, integrated patient-centered primary health care, and employment programming. We've been recognized as one of the top 30 clinics in the U.S. by the Robert Johnson Foundation. Our federally qualified health center for the homeless served 7,900 extraordinarily complex patients last year, most of whom suffer from a combination of homelessness, severe poverty, and chronic medical and behavioral health conditions. Central City Concern is fortunate enough to receive funding through the Federal Health Resources and Services Administration to fund our two OHP assisters. Since October of 2012, Central City Concern has assisted over 8,000 people in the Portland metro area to enroll in OHP. In 2015, many of the state-funded assisters were defunded, and we saw an increase in the number of people needing this support. While our assisters have had over 12,000 encounters with people requesting support and enrolling on OHP since inception, over half of those occurred in 2016 as a result of reduction in funding for assisters in our community. Furthermore, the demand far exceeds our ability to consistently help. Our capacity prohibits us from being able to staff the largest shelter in Portland and other area shelters, day programs, Clackamas County Service Center, and site and park-based feeding programs. We support this bill because we see a desperate need for people who could benefit from OHP coverage but still don't have it. Not only are people needing assistance in securing coverage for the first time, but people are also needing assistance in renewing their coverage given the limitation of OHA's ability to reach people by phone and mail. Our assisters employ trauma-informed engagement skills to assist extremely vulnerable individuals who are living or on the brink of homelessness, in poverty, and with severe mental or medical behavioral health conditions to secure OHP coverage and connect with a patient-centered primary care home. Based on the volume of work that our two assisters face, we can say with confidence that there remain large numbers of qualifying OHP members who have yet to be enrolled or who are losing their coverage as a result of the required renewal process. We suspect some of these individuals continuing to resort to high costs or unnecessary emergency room utilization. Thank you for your efforts to fill the needed void in funded assisters.
Thank you.
My name is Christian Giffen, for the record, and I'm an OHP member. And so in my experience,
I had to renew my insurance. It was a struggle to get it renewed. I had to wait a couple months and go without a medication. I have Crohn's disease, and I had to go without that medication for almost 2 months due to my paperwork being lost in the shuffle somewhere. And so that's all I have to say.
It was not a very happy experience.
No, not at all.
But eventually you got straightened out?
Yes, eventually.
Yes, sir.
Good afternoon, Representative Greenleaf, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Roberto, and I work for Transition Projects of Portland, Oregon. I'm here to give you my story of how OHP helped me out when I first got here to Portland. I moved here May 15th, will be 3 years, and I moved here at an opportune time, so to say. Housing was affordable, health care was available, and I moved here to get clean and sober, so I got into treatment, and matter of fact, I came here with nothing. I came from California with no health insurance, nothing at all, fresh start and all that. And I got enrolled with Central City Concerns Outpatient Program and Transition Projects Resources, and they pointed me into the direction of Outside In Clinic, where I still have my primary care doctor, and they enrolled me in Oregon Health Plan. It was the best thing that has ever happened to me. For the fact that, ripping and running on the streets, addicted to meth for 15 years, took a toll on my body, and I knew that fixing myself, physically was going to take some time, and having to see a doctor, but I didn't have the money or means to do it. So with the help of Oregon Health Plan, I was able to do a lot of take care of a lot of situations that my body needed taken care of. In my personal opinion, I believe that Oregon Health Plan and fixing whatever glitches it has and accessing it as its availability and access to people in recovery is a plus. The first thing that goes through one's mind when they're in recovery is, besides fixing myself mentally, I got to fix myself physically, and that means going to go see a doctor, but I don't have the money to do it. So the quick access and availability for it is a must, I think, everybody wants free health care, no doubt,
I believe everybody's entitled to
Yeah, healthcare. Of course, yeah. If it was given to me, I believe it should be given to everybody else. The access should be available and ready for everybody. Basically it, thank you for letting me testify.
Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Any questions to this panel? Could you call the next panel, please?
Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony.
Martin Taylor, Lisa Anderson, and John Mullen.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Martin Taylor has graciously allowed me to testify first so I can get to another meeting. For the record, John Mullen with the Oregon Law Center. And we've testified previously on health issues and the relationship to our mission. I just want to mention a couple of things about this bill. We're generally supportive of the concepts. When Cover Oregon failed, the technology failed, it really was the people, the caseworkers, the insurance agents, and the assisters that made it possible for people to enroll and to also be renewed. We remain concerned as we go forward into the future that we have stable funding for community assisters. The funding over time has been erratic, and we see this as a really important issue that the Los Center has been engaged in for a number of years, particularly around the renewal of people that can sometimes fall off of the OHP program, wind up coming back on fee-for-service, and takes a while to reengage with the coordinated care organizations. So however this bill goes forward, community-based aspect of assisters is really important, and this is particularly true of for people with language barriers, communities of color, other disenfranchised populations, to have somebody that really is directly there in their best interest for the person, the participant in the Oregon Health Plan. And with that, I would just say if this bill has further discussion, we're happy to engage in it and definitely support
you
the
general
concept.
You have changes to propose to the bill?
No, I don't. I would simply note, though, that one issue that is not in the bill is the issue relating to assisters for people who are in the exchange. There's a need for that. This is really focused on the Oregon Health Plan. The exchange, for example, one critical issue is people sometimes don't know that they are better served by signing up for a silver plan because of the cost-sharing reductions which are still in place under the Affordable Care Act.
That is a separate question.
Pardon me?
That is a separate question.
Yes, it is. And if this bill deals directly with OHP, then we're certainly content with the language in the bill. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, John. Who's next?
So I think I'll go next, if that's right. For the record, my name is Martin Taylor. I'm the executive director of public affairs and marketing for Care Oregon, and I'm here representing Jackson Care Connect, Columbia Pacific, and Care Oregon today. This is actually a bill that Care Oregon helped draft, and I wanted to create some context. We didn't go first in the hearing. We had a number of folks who are members or assisters or working out in the community go first because we believe that this is a bill that we're introducing on behalf of our members. We really don't want this to be a conversation about CCOs and the Oregon Health Authority. It's true that we have worked with the Oregon Health Authority for some time to try to improve the enrollment and application process, but we're not here today as a plan. We really are here today as a representative of our members who come to us in a variety of ways and say we need help in the application and enrollment process. I want to start by saying today has been such a day of courage. If you've listened to these panels, you've had people who have brought their health identities and health issues to you, including today some folks who we contacted just at the end of last week and asked if they'd be willing to come and tell their story. I think there are folks who've never testified in front of a public hearing. They've never testified, period. Mm-hmm. And it's not an easy thing to come here. For those members who are talking about their enrollment challenges, for them, this is a really big moment. They're not looking to Care Oregon to solve this problem. They're looking to you to help solve this problem. I would say that the state has struggled a lot in the last 4 years in the enrollment and application process, and we've been trying to be very generous about that. The reality is we've changed enrollment systems 4 times in the last 4 years. We used to have a system where you could go to your county or state office and enroll with an individual. And then when we moved to the Cover Oregon, we wanted everyone to enroll online. But as we were making that transition, we sent out a fast-track enrollment process for everyone with food stamps to get into the ACA. And then we asked people to go to Cover Oregon, but that kind of blew up, maybe you noticed. And now we've got a written enrollment process, a paper enrollment. Now, I gave you all a copy of that enrollment application you've got in front of you. It's that thick packet that's like 40 pages long. So that's what we're asking for you to improve the assistance for enrolling in that. And we're about to move to a one system. Now, if you're a low-income person, particularly if you're challenged by language barriers or cognitive disabilities or even just the reality of being rural and poor, the constant changes in how you apply are a constant challenge. And the single best thing we've done as a state to meet that challenge is our application assisters. And you know what? There are communities that have zero application assisters, none. There are some places where you have quite a bit, but those application assisters have no job security because we fluctuate how many and how much money we put in and out, and those grants run out. So most of the best application assisters we hire into Care Oregon, and they stop being application assisters. It's true. There are a farm team, but that, for the member, isn't helpful. I want to give you a sense of the struggle that customer service at Care Oregon has, and to do that, I've brought a customer service representative from Care Oregon to talk to you about what that looks like. But before I put her on, I want to also give you the context of what it's going to mean for a low-income member in the one system, which is the fifth system that isn't here yet. It's sort of here. We've sort of begun to do it. The one system is going to be a great way for the state to improve what the state does. It means everybody is going to give all of their information to the state. It's going to cut down on the eligibility processing time. It's going to make the data better. It's going to be really great for the state. It's a great fix for the state. If you're a low-income person, you may or may not have routine access to the Internet. You may or may not know how computers work. Using a mouse may be a challenge. Getting halfway through an application online, as long as the one in front of you, and then realizing that you don't have all the necessary information in front of you, and having to start over, which may mean going back to the public library. If you've got a literacy barrier, and many of our members do, either because it's English isn't your first language, or because you didn't get very far in school, or because you have a cognitive disability. All of these are things that our members are going to face in this one system. It doesn't mean the one system is not great. It's great. It's going to make things better for the state. It's not necessarily going to make things better for all of our members. And the application assisters provide a critical role. I want to say that the legislation that we introduced 2 years ago to say, hey, the enrollment process isn't good enough, had some things in it that never really happened in the last 2 years. And I want to touch back on a couple of those things. One of those things is we asked the state to give us the email addresses of our members. There's lots of good things we can do with the email addresses for our members, and it's on the enrollment process for OHP. So it's a public record. So we just like, can you give us, in the data transfer, the emails that you collect in the application process? 2 years. That hasn't happened. You know one of the best things we can do with that email address? We can email our members to say you're about to have your eligibility expire. You're about to be unenrolled in the Oregon Health Plan. One-third of OHP members in the ACA population did not re-enroll. And of those, two-thirds didn't re-enroll. Of the third, two-thirds didn't re-enroll because we didn't have the right address for them. You know what moves with people when they change addresses? Their email. That doesn't mean that that very large percentage of people weren't eligible for the Oregon Health Plan and didn't need it. It simply means we have a housing crisis, low-income people move more, housing insecurity is a real thing, and we have a piece of data in the system we've asked for years that we can't get. And I don't understand it. Another thing we asked for in the bill is, can we maximize what we can do in Oregon as plans to help our members? And we have made no progress in maximizing what we as plans can do for our members. Now, in New York, they actually have plans that have gotten a federal waiver to do application assistance. This bill doesn't ask for that. We're simply asking to do as much as possible as the plans to help. And we're not doing that because we're angry or we're a CCO or trying to grow our business. No, we're doing this because our members are asking us to help them. So the experience of a member calling up a CCO and saying, I'm enrolled in your plan. I would like to re-enroll. And the answer from customer service is, I'm sorry, I can't help you with that. If any of your insurance companies told you they couldn't help you stay on your insurance plan, you would go, I have no understanding of why that would be the case, but we can't help you with that. We're going to refer you to the state. And sometimes the OHP line gets to folks in 10 minutes or less and has very few drop calls. And other times it gets overwhelmed and it's hours, literally hours on the phone waiting for the OHP enrollment specialist. So how does the member feel about their experience with their plan when we said we can't help you re-enroll for that giant form you've got in front of you, but I'll send you to a state line where you can sit on hold for hours? Not very good. That reflects badly on us. It reflects badly on our health plan. Frankly, it reflects badly on you. It's not a good system when it's not working. It's going to perform better, but it hasn't been working. And all we've asked is what is the maximum thing we can do under federal law to help our members? And we have not made progress in 2 years.
Why didn't we have some more?
Oh, man. I was just getting going, Mitch. All right. So I need this is the caveats I have to give at the end. This is what we're not asking for. There's a great letter with lots of sponsors. We got all these guys by Thursday. More folks are signing on. The folks that are signing on to the sign-on letter have one concern. They don't really want the CCOs to actually start hiring the application assisters. And I agree with this for two reasons. One, it's really important that community partners who are at the point of contact are doing the application assistance. And two, because we're not allowed to under federal law. So you can't really let us hire the application assisters. What we can do is we can give grants to provide application assistance. So we as a Care Oregon could give a grant to say Clatsop Community Action, And they, Clatsop Community Action, could hire an application assister, and there's no competition in Clatsop County. And we actually tried doing exactly that. We gave Clatsop Community Action a grant to hire an application assister, and the state then told Clatsop Community Action that they couldn't have an application assister because they'd receive money from us. So I would like the system to be such that we could help support our local community partners by giving away money to hire application assisters, particularly when there's no competition. And any interpretation of federal law that's more restrictive than that really needs to be scrutinized, because our folks disagree with OHA about what's possible. I think that's the caveat, but I do understand that the assister bill, the assister ratio in the bill might cause a fiscal, and I'd like to offer that many CCOs, Care Oregon included, would be happy to be the grant givers for some of those assisters. I'd like to turn over to customer service so you can hear sort of the data and the experience of what it's like to be on the receiving end of customer service calls.
Thank you. For the record, I'm Lisa Anderson with the member service team at Care Oregon. Our Oregon health plan redetermination calls are top five calls a month. Members call us with various issues because of their eligibility. They're going to their doctors, their counseling appointments, their methadone treatment, and they're being told they no longer have eligibility and they won't be seen. We have members that go to fill their blood pressure medications and their insulin medications, and they're turned away. They're told to call the caseworker line at the Oregon Health Plan or their plan. Many people are on minute phones, so our Oregon Health Plan caseworker line people are working very hard, but there's high call volumes for this topic, and people call us back frustrated. They're not able to hold that long. They're running out of minutes, and we say we're sorry, and we try to give them other resources, but the problem with that is they don't believe us. They're frustrated. They need their medication. Many of our members have been out of blood pressure medication for days, and they're unhappy with us, they're unhappy with the system, and they're fearful for their lives. One pain point is their minute phones, the whole time at the Oregon Health Plan, and the reduction in assisters and staff that's basically affecting the ability for many people to secure good health care or care at all because of the reductions. Thank you.
Thank you. We're going to move forward. We have one witness opposed. We'll call him next, and we have three more support. We're essentially out of time. Representative Maelstrom.
I just want to make a sort of a comment, sort of an amen to what was just said. In my former role as a public health nurse, one of the things that I would do when I was seeing new mothers would ask about their prenatal care, and often I would be seeing people because they didn't have prenatal care, and overwhelmingly the reason why they didn't get prenatal care is they couldn't get on Oregon Health Plan, and it wasn't because they were ineligible. When you dig it a little bit deeper, it's always, I got lost in the paperwork, the same stories you just heard, and I think of all the wasted care people should have had, particularly pregnant women and newborns that were at, really should have been able to get on the plan and just couldn't because of all the red tape.
Maybe we can do something about that. Could you call witnesses opposed?
Art, help me out.
Sivozowski.
See? Of Family Care. Sivozowski.
Hello. Chair Greenlee, for the record, my name is Art Sukhojevsky. I represent Family Care Health. And just to clarify, we're not necessarily opposed to the bill. We would just recommend some clarifying language in the base text. So just some background about Family Care Health. In 1984, Family Care Health began coordinating member health benefits and services for lives covered under the Oregon Health Plan. As the second largest coordinated care organization, we contract with thousands of health care providers to provide integrated physical, dental, and behavioral health care to approximately 120,000 Oregonians in Clackamas, Multnomah, Washington counties, and parts of Marion County. This committee has heard from OHA in the past regarding declining CCO enrollment and rising enrollment in fee-for-service. According to our most recent OHA data, between January 2016 and January 2017, CCO enrollment has fallen by 11%, while fee-for-service has risen by 9.4%. Family Care has been communicating to OHA every enrollment and eligibility issue that has surfaced with our members. We agree that this committee should certainly consider legislation that may help members re-enroll into their CCO or address the underlying systemic problems at the agency that cause unnecessary and disruptive breaks in service and care for an increasing number of OHP members. Family care tracks breaks in OHP member coverage. The committee may be alarmed to hear that 16% of family care members experienced a break in coverage as determined by the agency within the first 16 weeks of enrollment with family care.
We're very much concerned with the whole situation. That's why we're considering this bill.
Yes.
Will you be proposing alternatives to this bill or some amending
language? Yes, we would propose clarifying language in terms of the definition of independent nonprofit organization. We believe that there are nonprofits currently that are affiliated with coordinated care organizations, and we would recommend that the committee clarify whether those organizations can participate in hiring application assisters. And then we would also recommend that the application assisters in the regions of the state that have multiple coordinated care organizations, that they consider whether to steer members into one coordinated care organization or another. So those are things that we would like the committee to consider when moving forward.
We'll consider those. Thank you very much.
Quick question.
Yes.
Kenny Geyer.
Representative Nose.
Two quick questions. I think that you said you didn't want to limit the grants to nonprofit groups. So I wonder if you can give an example of the kind of group that you think it should be extended to. And then the other one was the concern around making sure that assisters didn't skew mm-hmm. enrollment in one or another. My understanding is just the enrollment application would go in and then would get decided by the system, unless there's some reason that you're following a medical provider. Is that correct?
So my understanding about the process is that the individual can select a CCO at the beginning of the process in a situation where there's more than one available. And then the application would continue from that point on. And then in your earlier question,
whether grants could go to other groups other than not-for-profits. I think that's what you said.
He
was saying not nonprofits that are affiliated with one or the other of a CCO.
So we support nonprofits being involved. We support application assisters. We support more of them. In the context of this bill, we're just commenting that perhaps the committee consider a more clearly defined nonprofit organization.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Could you call the last panel, please?
Sean McNulty, Linda Roman, and Jesse O'Brien.
I recommend you all keep your eye on the clock while you're talking.
Chair Greenlink and members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Sean McNulty. I work as an application assister for Project Access Now. It's a nonprofit that connects people with healthcare services. Our outreach and enrollment department helped enroll 17,000 people in an Oregon Health Plan last year, which represents about 4.5% of the total Medicaid population of the Tri-County area where we serve. I'm here today to testify to the value of community partners' work serving Oregonians and urge your support for the concepts in this bill. The enrollment and renewal process, as you've heard, is daunting for many clients, especially the most vulnerable. Community Partners' work is focused largely on serving these most vulnerable populations. One good example of that is Outside In's work going directly to the homeless tent camps and knocking on people's tents and making sure they're enrolled in plans and helping reach them where people are. And these community partner organizations are willing to go the extra mile and make sure these clients get connected to care, who are often the most high utilizers of healthcare services that are going to result in the long-term savings for the program.
I'm imagining knocking on a tent.
Zipping or something like that. I don't know myself, but that's something that Outside In specializes in. Other populations, such as those with physical or mental disabilities, those facing language barriers, immigration status barriers, the Native, Latino, Asian, COFA populations, justice-involved, patients with addictions, AIDS patients, the LGBT community, there are assistance organizations that are dedicated to each of these individual groups and are working and can't be paralleled in their individual sphere. Without the dedicated outreach from these organizations, these populations would be facing even greater disparities in accessing healthcare. I also want to say that the assist organizations take a lot of load off of the call center and the processing center themselves. Every time we do an application correctly and it goes through smoothly is a reduced number of applications that are going and get held up in the process. If the client has to submit an application multiple times, that's just taking up more of the processing center's workload, which is already strained trying to meet the demands of urgent clients. This is only more important in the case in urgent medical cases, like when to your point about pregnancy being one of the Representative Malmstrom's point about pregnancy being one of the most severe issues. We've had just last week a client miscarried while waiting for their OHP paperwork to process. We've had clients come in with their newborn baby after doing the application while pregnant. They still haven't received coverage, and they came in with a newborn baby who had a heart condition and needed care that day to get a heart defect fixed, and we were able to resolve that day. And this is really where the community partner program shows the most of its greatest value is in making sure that clients get the best services.
There are competing CCOs. Do you steer people to one or the other of the CCOs?
At the end of the application, it lets us select which CCO the client wants. It's entirely up to the client. We don't steer them to any particular CCO, and often the clients honestly don't have that much information about which CCO they want unless they're already established with the primary care provider and want to keep the previous one. So we are entirely unbiased in that, and clients would actually like more information on how to do that. We also take a significant load off the call center as well. I wanted to follow up on the point of when people get referred from Care Oregon to the call center. The call center doesn't do phone applications for anyone who is not in an urgent case situation or has language barriers. So then after they've waited on hold for 2 hours, they're getting directed over to us to come into one of our locations. So that's often, there's multiple stages. If they have an application in the middle of the process, we have to send a request to OHA to diagnose the problem. It comes back to us. This is, the more we are empowered to do work for the processing center, the more efficient the whole system is for everybody, and I just wanted to impress that point on there.
So you support this bill in its form?
We support this bill in large point. I did want to raise the issue that the bill requires one assister per 10,000 plan members. That results in about 100 application assisters statewide, which is less than what we have right now by a significant margin. And I would also be interested to see whether there's any plans for requiring that assisters be available in each service area or something like that. There doesn't seem to be any requirement that rural communities have equitable access to assisters or anything like that. But in conclusion, the Community Partner Program is serving the communities that are most vulnerable and most in need of, or that struggle most with the renewal process, and supporting the Community Partner Program is a powerful way to make the whole enrollment system more efficient for everybody, whether or not.
Thanks.
Face difficulties.
Linda, Jesse, who's next?
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, hello again. I'm Jesse O'Brien. I'm the policy director for OSPIRG, which is the Oregon State Public Interest Research Group. I can be very brief because almost everything I wanted to say has already been said by others. We are in support of this bill. We think enrollment assisters are the unsung heroes of health system transformation and expanding access to coverage here in Oregon. And it's really important, as some folks have said before, to make sure that this is a stable workforce, that that the state continues its commitment to making this assistance available. It's really invaluable to consumers all over the state. I would also like to echo Mr. Mullen's comments about how, looking forward, it would be good to think about how to better coordinate this workforce with the work of assisting people through the health insurance marketplace. There is a pot of funding that the Department of Consumer and Business Services administers that helps fund, I think in some cases, some of the same nonprofit groups to help people sign up through the health insurance marketplace. And I really wish that those programs were maybe a little bit more coordinated than they are today. But we do support this bill. It's a great bill.
I think we had a little problem trying to coordinate those programs too close.
And that is part of why this bill is necessary, is because we seem to have problems setting up processes that we don't need a large workforce to help people navigate.
Great.
Chair, Vice Chairs, members of the committee, my name is Lynette Roman. I'm the Director of Health Policy and Government Relations with the Oregon Latino Health Coalition and the Oregon Health Equity Alliance. OHE is a 40-member organization that includes Unite Oregon, APANO, the Asian Health Center, the Oregon Latino Health Coalition, Urban League, and NAYA, the Native American Youth Authority. All these organizations that I mentioned, are many of them are trusted community partners with CCOs, but also more importantly, they're trusted community members that have been supporting outreach and enrollment. OHE is strongly in support of House Bill 2838 because it is a solution that bridges Oregonians to the healthcare they need faster. I want to talk about three pieces of the bill that are particularly important for OHE's members. By improving the ratio of application assisters to medical assistant recipients, it will help make enrollment to Medicaid less stressful and complicated, and less complicated for OHP recipients. Community-based organizations play a critical role in ensuring that our communities understand how to navigate and how to apply to the Oregon Health Plan with culturally and linguistic appropriate navigation that our enrollment assisters provide. Secondly, it allows by allowing CCOs to provide grant funding to entities that house application assisters in the community, it is it's vital to ensure the triple aim. And not only saves money in the long run, which my colleague spoke to, but it respects that communities themselves have the expertise and relationships to reach into pockets of their neighborhood. It's important that communities themselves lead the outreach efforts and that outreach is reflected by the communities that are most affected by it. And finally, by allowing members to re-enroll into the Oregon Health Plan in areas that are served by a single CCO will limit disruptions to the continuity of care and plans. These are all solutions that we all believe in, and we strongly support this bill.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions? Thank you. Thank you very much. We'll ask for a fiscal on this bill and see where it is, and if anybody has amendments to propose, do it quickly. I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2838, and unless there's anything more to be brought before the committee, we are adjourned. Committee?